One. What trade did you have? What was your job before you joined the RNAS?
I was an engine fitter, internal combustion, on London General Omnibus engines and Straker Squire chain-driven models owned by the Great Eastern Omnibus Company. And we were introduced there to a workshop, which we had to carry out crankshaft grinding and general maintenance for petrol-driven engines. And I had an ambition then, partly through the sinking of the Lusitania, etc., etc. We all felt very angry about that, and we felt we ought to do something towards this danger, which is threatening all of us. And I applied to join the Royal Naval Air Service, and they sent me to be medically examined at Admiralty Arch, and I was in the hope then of joining a seaplane squadron to such an extent that I'd bought textbooks on the matter, Anzani, Italian engine, and rotaries, Lirone, and Nanome, hoping it would the knowledge would be useful on seaplanes. But as it turned out, I never saw a seaplane to work on. I was attached to the kite balloon section, then being formed for the first time.
What medical examination did you have at Admiralty House?
Well, a very strict one. We stripped off, of course, in our birthday suits, and examined us very keenly all over. And one amusing incident was the young man who was being examined with me. He stood by my side, each doctor examining two recruits more or less at the same time. And he was particularly keen on testing your hearing. I would notice him holding his watch a foot behind the recruit's ear on my left, and say, "Can you hear it now?" And he'd say, "Yes, sir." And he'd put it behind him, right behind him, and he said, "Can you hear it now?" And he'd say, "Yes, sir," which would be a lie, or "No, sir," as the case may be. So when it came to my turn to have, I knew the watch was being held somewhere near. He said, "Can you hear it now?" I said, "Yes." "Can you hear it now?" I said, "No, I can't." All was well. So I passed a hearing test. But the amusing part with the other recruit was the doctor said, "What do you do for a living? What are you?" He said, "I'm a footman. And I'm employed by a lady, forget her name now." He said, "I thought that." He said, "You're in poor shape, you know." He said, "You drink too much tea. Much too much." He said, "Your nerves are not too good. I can't pass you now, but if you care to return in 6 months' time, we might pass you." So I thought highly privileged. I passed mine. All was well. Yes.
Did you have then a trade test?
We had a trade test a week later at Wormwood Scrubs, where I was told to report there, which I did by omnibus, and the trade test was given before I was kitted up, before I was accepted, really. And the trade test consisted of filing an inch cube. It was mild steel they gave me, sawn off roughly by a hacksaw. And I had to file an inch cube correct by vernier. I had no micrometer. And this test was quite difficult, unless you knew how to do it, which of course I did. And no time limit. You could have speed all day if you need be, but I managed it, I suppose, in 2 or 3 hours by concentration, because once I stood by the vice, wielding my tools, which I was used to, all the files, everybody else and everything else was more or less out of my mind, and I was concentrating on filing this perfect cube because I didn't want to fail. Good Lord, that wouldn't do. And I verniered this thing up, and there was a petty officer there, engine room participant, and he was checking, and he said, he said, "Oh, it's all right, you'll do. Right, name please." And from there, we walked to a 3-ton lorry, Comma, and anyway, it was a 3-ton lorry, and he said, "Now, you're a driver, aren't you?" I said, "Oh, yes, I am." He said, "Well, get in there and drive me through to Hyde Park Corner, or Marble Arch." Marble Arch. So we went from Wormwood Scrubs through Notting Hill Gate to Marble Arch, round the arch, through the park, back through, I think it was through Kensington, to Notting Hill again, and back to Wormwood Scrubs, and I was passed. And I became then aircraft mechanic first class, which entitled me to 4 shillings a day. And from then on, having a rank, it made a great deal of difference to how you were treated when they found that you were a craftsman and you were, to them, quite valuable. I became sort of one of the elected few who was worth hanging on to. And it was there I received my number. 5838 AM1 5838, and it's stamped on my medal to this day. And from then on I had to receive my kit and hammocks, kit bag, boot brushes, everything possibly you could imagine in the early days of the war. And I had a white canvas hammock, and it was stretched out on the counter, and your initials in black paint was painted, stamped on the white canvas hammock. And I kept it for years with HT Holstock still stamped on, with letters an inch high, so there was no mistake. But I had to lug all these things to hammock and kit bag and things to Roehampton, where they told me to report, which I did, and I found it was a kite balloon section. So all my visions of servicing seaplane, which I thought would be so thrilling, disappeared into being made into a winch driver for balloons. Not very exciting, I thought, but as it turned out, quite useful. Yes.
What basic training did you do at Roehampton?
Well, we had foot drill, as usual, but on a polo ground. No concrete, no drill square as such, no grit surface, so we couldn't hear our boots thumping down in unison. It was all softly done, and no stamping either at the turns. But we were drilled by Royal Marine NCOs, sergeants to warrant officers. Very strict, very efficient. And it was there that we first were allowed to handle a rifle. We had 20 dual purposes only rifles, very old, not fit for anything else. And when we had our hour at rifle drill, present, etc., etc., order, arms, and all the various and various movements you can do with a rifle, we were stopped, and the 20 rifles handed over to the next 20. And apparently they were very scarce, but although they were dual purposes only, there were very few of them to be issued around to the rush of new recruits. And we were taught all sorts of... One particular thing I remember was the care we were instructed to give to our clasp knife, which was on a cord lanyard, Navy of course, and a very good Sheffield steel blade with a spike on the side, and you could open that for splicing ropes or wire rope, and if it was needed, and an ordinary blade on the other. But the warrant officer insisted that this should be sharpened up on a stone which we shared as we went around. This edge to this knife should always be razor sharp. The idea being that there might be an emergency where you might have to cut yourself free from something or cut your neighbour free from something. So always was the clasp knife drill, always a razor sharp edge. And I even to this day try and keep up to that, because what's the good of having a blunt knife? So that was one of the many things that he taught us, and to naval tradition. And we were very proud of being Navy and not these common army chappies. In fact, we drilled next door to the London Scottish, who were camped in Richmond Park, quite close. And we used to pass each other within a few hundred yards when route marching, but we never met. Perhaps as well. And they always steered us apart, but it was very sad, really, because they went to France and were rather badly cut up, I believe, at their first battle of, or the second battle of Ypres, I think they were. London Scottish were hit very badly. So lots of those lovely lads who we saw swinging their kilts to the air of the behind the skirling pipes never came back.
Was your unit very keen? Did you do lots of training till late at night?
Yes, we used to. We were very keen on being efficient airmen, and we never went out much, any of us. We used to practice knotting, cordage, splicing ropes, wire ropes, Turk's head knots, all sorts of fancy knots. We'd practice those in the evening to become efficient, to get a word of praise the next day from the petty officer instructor. And used to look at us. He knew we'd been practicing hard, so our spare time was pretty well all taken up with practice through our sheer keenness, really. And which meant that within a few weeks from being sent to, within a month of going to Roehampton, I was in France, totally untrained for warfare. Really, I couldn't even fire a rifle as such. But so we had a compressed sort of form of training, voluntary. We liked it so much, we wanted to do so well, we used to work in our own time in the evenings, even practicing Morse and semaphore signalling one end of the field to the other, that sort of thing.
Did you train with balloons while at Roehampton?
Yes, we had an old Draken there for practice purposes. It was never used in flight as far as I know, but it was there for us to learn the various guide ropes and the netting on the side which held the whole thing together. We had to practice with that. And the other thing was the active part of ballooning, which we liked very much, was we used to have night flights from there in a spherical balloon. And that was practice for us for topping up with hydrogen, learning the various ropes and how to attach the lines to the basket, etc., etc. And especially to find out how the ripcord worked, the red one, to pull in emergency only. And we used to have night flights from there with one officer, one rating. And if the wind was right, when I went, floating up into the darkness, starlight night, not much wind, I did notice the clarity of the noises beneath. You passed a farm. You knew it was a farm because you could hear the cattle lowing, or a dog barking, or even people shouting, "Shut up there, Mark," to the dog, little thinking that 1,000 feet up, there were people who could listen to his, clearly to his every word. It's rather amusing. And we came down just east of Colchester in Essex and were picked up by lorry and brought back afterwards. Of course, the drill being then to ensure that you both had a hand on the ripcord at the same time, so as you pulled together, and not one left the basket without the other. That was a secret. Because if one leapt off, ripcord or no ripcord, it would leap into the air with all that weight being reduced by half, and he'd shoot into the air, only to crash perhaps with a broken limb or worse later on. So the drill was to remain in the basket until the last thing, the result being, although you poured the ripcord, there was so much gas in there that you would drag through hedges and over fields. It didn't matter much because you would crouch well down in the bottom of the basket. It didn't matter, really. And then our job then was to fold up and wait for the nearest transport or the nearest telephone. It meant walking a mile sometimes, perhaps, or wherever you've got to get a phone. And by that time, it was the early hours in the morning, and you telephone through to say where you were, and they'd pick you up by lorry. So that was our first experience of ballooning, nighttime, but never in the daytime, only nighttime.
How were you able to control the height of the balloon, its altitude?
Not really, because there was no level flight as such. You progress forward in a series of ellipses. If you threw a few handfuls of sand out to go higher, you would go higher quite rapidly for a bit, or one bag of sand tipped out would be enormous leap in height. But then you would eventually drift down again. So as you touched rock bottom, and then you tip a bit more out. So you were proceeding in a manner of the caterpillar, who takes a grip with his forelegs and hifts his hump back with the back legs. So that was the shape of the flight of the balloon in the air. You progress in a series of huge ellipses, and it was judging the amount of sand you threw out so you wouldn't leap too high, because if you leaped high, you came equally down low. And it was very difficult. You had to be very sparing with the ballast to ensure a comparatively smooth flight, although it was fascinating and very peaceful up there. No noise. Wonderful.
You didn't release any gas until the end of the flight?
No. You release the gas usually with the ripcord. That was the emergency. You came very close, perhaps at high speed, 15, 20 miles an hour, skimming a field 15 feet up, but that was no time to pull the ripcord. Going at that speed, you had to gauge in such a way that perhaps a few practice bumps on the bottom, knowing you were almost grounded, then together you could pull and leave the craft at the same time, usually tumble out and fumble around, and you were surrounded and enveloped entirely by this envelope of the balloon, which was of course then flat on the ground.
Was there any special way of packing up the balloon?
Yes, there was. They had to be folded towards the deflation part, the ripcord valves, it were. They had to be wrapped around that in a certain manner so that it was square. It was a square fold, the ends in, the sides in, the ends in, the sides in, over the valve proper, so that it was square. And it could fit into a huge canvas bag, which was corded with eyelet holes. You could put it in the canvas.